Just cranking up the old Cool Edit program. So hopefully this time our program shall be recorded for posterior, or make that posterity. Once again, I'm Ren Tawil. I bring you Mideast Madness, the radio show that is, every Monday at 1500 hours, 3 p.m., here on the west coast of North America. A lot to do today, a lot to get to. Therefore, we shall dispense with the opening music. What a week it's been, huh, folks? Out of the tens of thousands of people who listen to the show, without a doubt, tens of thousands, at least some of you must know that I'm going to say something in regards to this past week's events, vis-a-vis the latest Boston massacre. I do hope it was not terribly politically incorrect to use that term, talking about the bombings at the Marathon. To my, well, after the initial heartbreak of hearing that happen at all, and getting an email notice from my cousin who lives there in Boston with a significant other most of the time, we exchange a couple of emails. On top of a disaster like that, a domestic disaster like a bombing, like a terrorist act, whether it really is a terrorist act or just like a terrorist act, and I'm not terribly clear on the differences between the two, but every time one of these happens, it is a double whammy for old Ren here. Being a Palestinian American that I am, I have to deal with the reality of the world of Islam, of militant, hardline Islam, and what it does to the whole picture. My mic is not doing what I want it to today. Okay, that's the best I can get, I think. Fortunately for me, and I say that with some reserve, that it is fortunate for me I am not Muslim. I was raised in the Lutheran Church. My Jerusalem, Palestine-born father being himself raised as a Christian. But I'm always careful because I don't want to just use that as an excuse and say, hey, don't blame me. I'm not Islamic. I'm not a Muslim. Because I still have to take a certain degree of responsibility. Not for the act itself, but for my defense of the rights of all individuals involved and seeking justice for all individuals involved. Okay, so we'll start. As I said earlier, we got a lot to do. I'm trying to keep the mealy-mouthing part of old Ren Tawil here at a limitation. This is from Edge of Sports. Protecting the Boston Marathon from ourselves. I'm not sure exactly who or what Edge of Sports is, but this item was extracted from thenation.com. Why we must protect next year's Boston Marathon from ourselves. By Dave Zinn. Let's listen closely, kids, and give this some thought. if emerging victorious after being down 3-0 to the Yankees in the 2004 playoffs should have taught us anything, it's that the people of Boston are tough as hell and never lose faith. After Monday's bombing of the Boston Marathon and the following days under lockdown, we are already seeing that resilience emerge. Already, people in the city are talking about how the marathon next year is going to be bigger and better than ever. Already, runners are signing up in droves. This is for next year's marathon now, folks. Already, according to one website, the race in 2014 could have, quote, 15 to 20 times the number of people attempting to qualify. As Raymond Britt, a marathon analyst who ran the 26.2-mile course for 13 consecutive years, said, we believe it's an extraordinary sign of the community, of the running community's desire to support Boston. They want to come to Boston in 2014 to defend her honor, take our race back from evil, to prove the spirit of freedom will prevail over all, end quote. Bloomberg News also ran a story about the commitment of runners to retake Heartbreak Hill in 2014. If anyone knows, anyone out there knows what exactly Heartbreak Hill refers to, I happen to suspect that it's the specific bend in the race where the bombing took place. If you know, you can give me a call at area code 831-427-3772. Again, 831-427-3772. Live and direct to the studio, to me here. I'm all by my lonesome. Line two is same area code 831-469-3119. I await your call at any point. Don't worry about interrupting me, interrupting anything, music, whatever's going on. We'll be here for a little less than the next 2 hours. Back to the article. Entitled, Why We Must Protect Next Year's Boston Marathon from Ourselves, by Dave Zinn. Dave Zinn says, I in no way doubt that next year will be a celebration of the city's stout-hearted fortitude. I have no doubt that people will arrive in droves to witness, quote, the spirit of freedom prevail. But I do think we need to separate the bravery of those who will gather in 2014 and what the security imperatives will undoubtedly be. We need to critically examine what's proposed and, if necessary, raise our voices in protest. Safety is paramount, of course. But there is a difference between safety and submitting without dissent to being under a kind of martial law. I want to describe the possible dystopic scenario that next year's marathon could bring. And I'm not pulling this out of a pamphlet written by Glenn Beck. I'm speaking from the experience of having been in Vancouver right before the 2010 Winter Olympics. Again, Dave Zinn speaking, writing here. I'm reading from his words. I'm speaking from the experience of having been in Vancouver right before the 2010 Winter Olympics, South Africa right before the 2010 World Cup, and London right before the 2012 Summer Olympics. In each of these cities, security meant raiding the homes and offices of, quote, people of interest, end quote. It meant spying on activist groups planning legal protests. It meant a particular level of surveillance and harassment of black and brown communities, especially, but certainly not exclusively, the Arab and Muslim communities. It meant displacement of many of the homeless and those in nearby low-income housing to create a security perimeter. It meant, in the case of London, surveillance drones flying overhead. In all of these cities, there were so many video cameras that you couldn't so much as scratch your behind without fearing that someone was making a note. In all these cities, I felt safe. But safe in the way you feel in quiet, empty campgrounds. It's eerie. Even if you aren't thinking about the collateral damage needed to feel so, quote, safe. In all these cities after the games, much of this top-notch surveillance equipment becomes a, quote, normalized part of law enforcement. As one police chief said when I was in London, it's not like we can just put them back in the box. Just trying to increase the light level here. Make up for the slight lack of flexibility of the mic boom here. Continuing with the article. There are undoubtedly many people that will accept this trade-off. The Boston Marathon must be run, and if it needs to happen under military watch, then so be it. This argument is easy, but a grave mistake, and it's why we need to protect the 2012 race from ourselves. Instead of blank-faced compliance, we should take immediate steps. This means building movements now for citizen oversight on the security operations for 2014. This means building movements now against the militarization of the police force. This means building movements now against Islamophobia and the harassment of black and brown youth. And yes, we should appreciate the awful irony that criminal actions of two white guys will spur state harassment of people of color. By taking this approach, says Mr. Zinn, we can do more than preserve our civil liberties. We can also preserve as much as possible of what is so communitarian and precious about the race itself. The Boston Marathon is the most open mass sporting event on earth, with 500,000 people gathering over 8 different cities. Maybe it will never be the wide open innocent party of years past again, but in honor of those determined to gather, run, and not live in fear, we shouldn't easily surrender what made the Boston Marathon, not to mention our civil rights, so mighty in the first place. Dave Zinn is the author of the new book, Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down, from the New Press. Receive his column every week by emailing Dave, D-A-V-E, at edgeofsports.com. Contact him at edgeofsports@gmail.com. All in all, I think that's pretty much the, how should I say this? That's about as far as one can go if they'll dare let themselves in addressing what happened in Boston a week ago today. 1 week ago today, and not stepping on too many toes. And not upsetting people who feel that Mr. Zinn's remarks may be unfair or upsetting to them. But very eloquently put, he talks about the spirit of Boston, of winning and of sportsmanship, sportspersonship, sportswomanship, including the lady in the wheelchair, and then expressing his concern that we don't want next year's 2014 Boston Marathon to turn into another, as he puts it in here, To turn into another Vancouver Winter Olympics or South Africa right before the 2010 World Cup in London before the 2012 Summer Olympics. As he said, in each of these cities, security meant raiding the homes and offices of people of interest, quote unquote. It meant spying on activist groups, planning legal protests. It meant a particular level of surveillance and harassment of black and brown communities, especially, but certainly not exclusively, the Arab and Muslim communities. So, in all fairness, he is addressing the potential for abuse, even in the name of safety and security, based largely on his experience around the world. He has every right to do so, and I, for one, welcome his words. Dave's in. Posted in thenation.com, why we must protect next year's Boston Marathon from ourselves. Again, those phone numbers are 427-3772 and 469-3119. It is 3:18 Pacific Daylight Time. This is the Mideast Madness Show coming to you live. This April 22nd Earth Day on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. All right, let's do another one of these. Still on the subject, actually, that's the only item I had directly addressing the bombing and concerns surrounding the bombing. Let's do, hang on here. It's, oh no, no, that's not it. You see, Mr. Zinn, Dave Zinn, offhand, I would say both Dave and Zinn are probably Jewish names. And yes, indeed, I read a lot of stuff from Jewish authors and philosophers. It's all the more comforting to me when a person of the Jewish faith and of Jewish blood can show sympathy towards those in the Muslim world who are innocent of any wrongdoing, at least along the lines of bombings and terrorism. Now I have something, assuming this darn computer gets a move on here. Shoot. No, that's not it. Hi. Please keep in mind, folks, we are a totally non-commercial service. A continuing and outright act of civil disobedience, Free Radio is, like so many other outlets around the world. And as such, it's quite understandable that we're not going to receive any corporate donations. In fact, we have restrictions among Free Radio Santa Cruz's bylaws, restricting donations to very small amounts from individual people. We do appreciate and badly need your help. We need in less than 2 months, we're going to need a new location for our radio transmitter. Apparently, we'll still be able to continue broadcasting online on the World Wide Web, but we need a new location for both our broadcasting tower and our studio. We can certainly use the new space, cheaper space for our studio, so we can retain our monetary responsibility here. But more importantly, the tower location has to be found on proper high ground. It's very low power. It pretty much serves only the city of Santa Cruz, California. And we'd like to keep it here not terribly far from the studio, continuing to serve Santa Cruz. Please send your donations, anything you got, folks, to Free Radio Santa Cruz, or just write FRSC on the envelope. Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. We do need donations, and if you listen to this show enough, maybe even not too much, you'll hear plenty of solicitations for your help. I pay monthly, as are most of the, well, all the other programmers either pay or owe money for the privilege of doing this. The rest comes from you, my friends. Send your donations to FRSC P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California. That's Santa, as in you know who, Cruz, second word Cruz, C-R-U-Z, California, zip code 95061. Second item, dispatched April 14th. That would have been a week ago yesterday. Let's see if I... Okay. This is a piece entitled, "We Mustn't Allow Muslims in Public Life to Be Silenced." Again, listen, consider, and call me on those phone lines that I just gave you twice now. If you want to address this, argue about it, bring up something that you think I'm leaving out. But this article is entitled, "We Mustn't Allow Muslims in Public Life to Be Silenced." Written by Mehdi Hassan in The Guardian. I'm sure that refers to the UK Guardian. Sunday, 8... Aha. Aha. Sunday, 8 July 2012. So someone had recently got a hold of this, almost a year ago. Have you ever been called an Islamist? How about a jihadist or a terrorist? Extremist, maybe. Welcome to my world. It's pretty depressing. Every morning I take a deep breath and then go online to discover what new insult or smear has been thrown in my direction. Whether it's tweets, blog posts, or comment threads, the abuse is as relentless as it is vicious. Again, this piece from the UK Guardian, written by Mehdi Hassan, who writes, "You might think I'd have become used to it by now. Well, I haven't. When I started writing for a living, I never imagined I'd be the victim of such personal, such Islamophobic attacks on a near daily basis. By joining the New Statesman in 2009, I was promptly subjected to an online smear campaign involving a series of selectively edited videos of speeches I delivered in front of groups of Muslim university students several years ago. I was accused of being a, quote, secret member of the extremist group Hizb ut-Tahrir and a, quote, dangerous Muslim shithead," end quote, in the, quote, same genre, end quote, as the Nazis. The post that sticks in my mind is from the blogger who referred to me as a, quote, moderate cockroach, whose Islamic faith was, quote, no different from the Islam of Abu Hamza, Abu Qatada, Ayman al-Zawahiri, Anjem Shudari, or any of the, subquote, tiny minority, end subquote, of Islamic terrorists who believe that Islam must dominate no matter what the cost, end quote. 3 years later, as I leave the New Statesman to join the Huffington Post United Kingdom, little seems to have changed. Quote, Huffington Post's new UK political director brings pro-Iran baggage, end quote, screamed the headline on the Fox News website back in late May. This would have been May of 2012, of course, last May. My baggage? I once publicly praised a fatwa from Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, forbidding the production of nuclear weapons. Shame on me. Another ultra-conservative U.S. news website, the Washington Free Beacon, referred to me as the, quote, HuffPo's house jihadi. The mere mention of the words Islam or Muslim generates astonishing levels of hysteria and hate on the web. As one of only two Muslim columnists in the mainstream media, the other being the Independent's Yasmin Alibhai Brown, a little stick in the throat there, sorry. I have the dubious distinction of being on the receiving end of much of it. In August 2011, for instance, I wrote a lighthearted column in The Guardian on Ramadan, examining how Muslim athletes cope with fasting while competing. The article provoked an astonishing 957 comments, the vast majority of which were malicious, belligerent, or both. As one perplexed commenter observed, there is much we might criticize Islam for. But to see the amount of hatred being spewed on this thread on an article about something as innocuous as fasting really makes one wonder. Indeed. And it isn't just pieces about Muslims. A recent interview of mine with the Shadow Chancellor, Ed Balls, elicited the following response. Get out of my country, goat fucker. How many other political columnists have to deal with such, quote, feedback? And how many of my fellow pundits in the British media get death threats in the Post, warning them that, quote, there will not be one live Muslim left in Europe when we have finished? Eh? From my perspective, the British commentariat can be divided into three groups. The first consists of a handful of journalists who regularly speak out against the rising tide of anti-Muslim bigotry. From the Telegraph's Peter Osborne, I guess, to a bevy of Guardian columnists, including Jonathan Freeland, Seamus Milne, and Gary Young. The second group consists of those writers such as The Mail's Melanie Phillips, The Telegraph's Charles Moore, and The Spectator's Douglas Murray, who see Islam and Muslims as alien, hostile, and threatening. Phillips has referred darkly to a fifth column in our midst. Murray has said, and I quote, conditions for Muslims in Europe must be made harder across the board, end quote. I'm still here, grabbing a sip of Diet Cola and picking my shirt up off the cold concrete floor of this studio. Nom nom. But it is the third group, and perhaps the biggest, that concerns me most. These commentators, who boast otherwise impeccable anti-racist credentials, yet tend to be silent on the subject of Islamophobia. Journalists who cannot bring themselves to recognize, let alone condemn, the growing prevalence of anti-Muslim feeling across Europe, or acknowledge the simple fact that the targeting of a powerless brown-skinned minority is indeed a form of racism. I'm a fan of robust debate, and I'm not aware, and I'm I'm a fan of robust debate, and I'm not averse to engaging in the odd ad hominem attack, say that five times fast, odd ad hominem attack myself. This isn't a case of special pleading on behalf of Britain's Muslims, nor do I think my Islamic beliefs should be exempt from public criticism. But the fact is that you can now say things about Muslims in polite society, and even among card-carrying liberal lefties, that you cannot say about any other group or minority. Am I expected to shrug this off? Again, I am reading from an item written by Mehdi Hassan from the UK Guardian, July 8th, 2012. We mustn't allow Muslims in public life to be silenced. Please keep in mind this Mr. Hassan. This Mehdi Hassan is apparently, likely, a British citizen, so he's bringing up a number of names that will more readily be connected to the British media, written media, and keep in mind that this is a Muslim living in Great Britain, and this is where he's coming from. But it is the third. Okay, I remember. Okay, continuing. The truth is that the fear-mongering and negative stereotyping is out of control. I've lost count of the number of websites that try to, quote, out every Muslim in public life as an extremist or Islamist of some shape or form. The promotion of Saida Warsi to the conservative front bench in 2007... provoked the influential Conservative Home website to describe her appointment as, quote, the wrong signal at a time when Britain is fighting a global war against Islamic terrorism and extremism, end quote. Labour's Sadiq Khan, K-H-A-N, the shadow justice secretary, was accused of holding, quote, extremist views after he called for a, quote, more independent foreign policy, and was spuriously linked to Hizb ut-Tahrir. In April, Labour peer Lord Ahmed was suspended from the party after he was falsely accused of having put a £10,000 bounty on Barack Obama's head. Falsely accused of having put the bounty on Barack Obama's head, the suspicion has since been lifted. If Muslims such as Warsi, Khan, Ahmed, and me are all secret extremists, who are the moderates? That, of course, seems to be the implicit, insidious message. There aren't any. Seems to be the message. But if those of us who try to participate in public life and contribute to public debate are constantly painted with a broad brush of suspicion and distrust, then what hope is there for the thousands of young British Muslims who feel alienated and marginalized from the political process? I used to encourage Muslim students to get involved in the media or in politics, but I now find it much harder to do so. Why would I want anyone else to go through what I've gone through? Believe me, Muslims aren't endowed thicker skins than non-Muslims. Okay, I see we're still recording well, running well. Continuing with article. Finishing up the article. To say that I find the relentlessly hostile coverage of Islam, coupled with the personal abuse that I receive online, depressing, is an understatement. There have been times, for instance, when I found my wife curled up on our couch in tears, after having discovered some of the more monstrous and threatening comments on my New Statesman blog, when I've wondered whether it's worth it all. Perhaps a voice at the back of my head suggests I should throw in the towel and go find a less threatening, more civilized line of work. But that's what the trolls want. To silence Muslims, to deny a voice to a voiceless community. I shouldn't have to put up with this abuse, but I will. I have no plans to let the Islamophobes win. So, dare I ask, who's with me? ending on a note of rally cry, is rallying cry. Am I shouting into the wind in the darkness? Is anyone out there? I feel that I've read stuff like this before, but I think it has more to do with my personal identity to the plight of the innocent Muslim, all of whom are painted with the broad brush by, in some corners, even from famous voices, as being dangerous to Western society and Western values, and that they want to kill us all. So, but I think Mehdi Hasan spells out pretty much what I've been suspecting and thinking in a few details that I've heard the likes of. It's 3:37 in the afternoon here in Santa Cruz, California. Let's see what other wonderful items we have for you. I'll tell you what. Last Tuesday, April 9, in the big city paper here of the Santa Cruz Sentinel, in the world section, someone wanted me to read this. I have not pre-read it, so let's see what it says, shall we? Associated Press writes, Kerry pushes ambitious Mideast peace plan. Actually, the Associated Press passed along the article. It's generally the editors of the newspaper in question who writes the headline. The headline is, Kerry, referring to Secretary of State John Kerry, pushes ambitious Mideast peace plan. Short article. Jerusalem. Secretary of State John Kerry worked Monday to corral Israeli and Palestinian leaders into a new and ambitious peace process that includes reviving parts of a long dormant plan embraced by the Arab world a decade ago, officials said. The 2002 initiative that Kerry wants to revive parts of would have provided Israel recognition throughout the Arab world in exchange for a pullout from territory conquered in 1967. On his third trip to Jerusalem in the last 2 weeks, can you imagine doing all that flying? Assuming it's always from the United States. On his third trip to Jerusalem in the last 2 weeks, Kerry committed himself to a multi-month peace push that could mean numerous follow-up trips to the region. He met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other senior Israeli and Palestinian officials Monday, a day after sitting down for private one-on-one talks with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah. Ramallah is the de facto current capital of Palestine for the time being. Quote, I am intensely focused on this issue in the region and the region because it is vital really to American interests and regional interests to try and advance the peace process, and because this festering absence of peace is used by groups everywhere to recruit and encourage extremism, Kerry told reporters. Let me read that again, not only because it's important, but because I had some difficulty saying it comfortably. Open quotation mark. I am intensely focused on this issue and the region because it is vital, really, to American interests and regional interests to try and advance the peace process, and because this festering absence of peace is used by groups everywhere to recruit and encourage extremism, end quote, Kerry told reporters. Both sides mistrust each other deeply, and there are reasons that mistrust is built up, he added. He continues, I am convinced that we can break that down. Kerry's foremost goal is to restart direct Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, which have been infrequent over the past 4.5 years. And in a break from previous U.S.-led efforts, he also wants to focus on a modified version of the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative. The initiative was revolutionary when Saudi Arabia introduced it and the 22-member Arab League endorsed it. It offered Israel comprehensive recognition in exchange for withdrawal from the lands it conquered in the 1967 Mideast War. End of article. From the Santa Cruz Sentinel. No author, it simply says, forwarded from the Associated Press. Good old AP. My friends, this is old Ren talking now. Every time I read an article like this, I always give myself a little ho-hum, and I read a little more, and I repeat to myself, ho-hum. Doesn't everyone, concerning stalled peace talks in the Israeli-Arab conflict, and will there ever be peace in the Middle East? This is only the latest report of the current plan or offer of a plan from the U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry. I appreciate the fact that he recognizes the value of the plan introduced by Saudi Arabia 11 years ago and endorsed by the 22-member Arab League. I appreciate his recognition of that. Although I must admit, at the time this came down 11 years ago, it was tossed off as just a mimicking of Israel's offer of peace. Which itself is really just more of the same old demands. Israel wants to be recognized and living within secure boundaries. And secondary thought given. It's always secondary, incidental thought given to the well-being of the Palestinians in the occupied territories and in the Gaza Strip. Maybe some kind of Palestinian state. They have... Going back 20 or 30 years ago, leaders such as Menachem Begin, then Prime Minister of Israel, would grudgingly accept quote-unquote legitimate rights of the Palestinians to their own state. This is a major flaw, in my opinion, is that the emphasis, as one-sided as it is, says everything must be based on recognition of a secure Israel by the Arab world, not to mention the rest of the world. And only once that happens will occupation troops of the Israeli military pull out of those territories it conquered in 1967. Only then will they pull away from the boundaries of the Gaza Strip and stop impinging that which has been referred to countless times. The Gaza Strip has been referred to countless times as the largest open-air prison on Earth. It is the single most densely populated area given its population factored into its tiny size, some 35 miles long. And up to 5 miles wide. Palestinian Arabs who live in Gaza do not have the freedom to come and go as they please into or out of the Gaza Strip, per se. The Israelis guard and closely monitor all action and all passing of anything, and all of the checkpoints, the gates that they share with Gaza, and of course the southern end of the strip, about 5 miles wide, borders Egypt. And Israel had a, having official peace with Egypt, almost most of the time a cold peace. Israel took advantage of Hosni Mubarak's sensitivity to the Muslim Brotherhood, which is Hamas in Gaza, fearing their takeover of Egypt, which seems to have happened now anyway, since Mubarak has been turned out on his ass. The Muslim Brotherhood has the prime ministership of Egypt, but they that has not completely ended Egypt's partnership with Israel in continuing to blockade the gates and allow only minimum passage of both people and supply. So much for Gaza. Point is, everything seems to have to be based on Israel's security. When you ask, what should it be instead? Everything should be based on absolute mutuality. Security for both Israeli and Palestinian Arab. Independence for both Israeli and Palestinian. Peace and security for both Israeli and Palestinian. It should be addressed that way and not just assume that once Israel gets what it demands and what it wants, that the rest will somehow flow to the Palestinians. And based on Israel's consistent behavior, particularly under the Netanyahu regime, it cannot be counted on. What does he do? The Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, champions the expansion and the unmovableness of their settlements in the West Bank. He's just carrying on his own ultra-right wing, nay, militant style, the Zionist dream of occupying all of historic Palestine. When the famed Judaic philosopher Theodore Herzl, who was most famously active, I should say infamously active, in the 1890s in generating and founding the Zionist movement of return of the Jews to their ancient homeland, or I should say to the ancient homeland of people who are, after all, two millennia, quite loosely connected, both by many traditions and by their own chromosomes, to the current followers of Judaism. Herzl demanded return of the Jews to Palestine, and the Palestine that he was talking about included an area extending on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea up to about the current Israeli-Lebanese border, then turning inland slightly, and then penetrating almost up to the Syrian-Turkish border, including current-day Damascus and areas well east of Damascus, into most of the current Kingdom of Jordan. a small sliver of Saudi Arabia, northwestern Saudi Arabia, and even a bit of land in the Sinai Peninsula. This was Herzl's vision of returning to redeem, as he put it, as I suppose the Old Testament puts it, the Jews returning to redeem the land in their name. That was his view, and the view of his followers, map of Palestine in their heads, or map of Israel in their heads. It's true that what comprises Israel is probably less than a quarter of all of that. So, those who are still alive, who are the biggest fans of Herzl, seem to feel cheated. Even holding on to the West Bank and potentially once again driving Arabs out of the Gaza Strip, even with all of that area, they feel cheated, seems to me. They want the rest of it. So here Mr. Netanyahu is pushing his settlement activity, and there is formal and not so covert. It's quite blatant encouragement and assistance from the government of Israel to these settlements. And of course, every time a settlement is established in the Arab territories, what's left of potential Palestine, I have to put all these proviso adjectives in there. What was I saying? Once these settlements are established, there are roads, very well paved and well marked with signage and all that, highways connecting Israel, post-1967 borders of Israel and Jerusalem in particular, to those settlements. Highways, which are generally for Jews only, for quote-unquote security purposes, as Palestinian Arabs are not allowed on or near them. And along with this terrible security wall that winds its way, separating not only Israel from Palestine, but the settlements in Palestine from the Palestinians, the wall and these roads continue to divide the Palestinian people from one another, from the other half of their property, their land. It isolates some villages and towns. And the really, if there's anything evil in this world, I try not to use the word evil because I think, because to me it just has too strong of religious connotations. But if there's ever a justification for using a word like evil, look to the mindset of Benjamin Netanyahu, who knows perfectly well that the settlement activity not only secures more land for the Jewish state, but that it contributes almost immeasurably to making the lives of the Palestinians more miserable. He knows this is happening. He simply doesn't care. Netanyahu knows how the typical American citizen's mindset has at least on the back burner of their minds this notion that Israel is the victim and that really Israel is the good guy and we have to do something in exchange for what we, broadly the whole world, what we did to the Jews in the Holocaust. I'm nervous about even using the word Holocaust. I'm wondering who's going to jump on my case for even saying it. The fact is, there is no legal or official connection between the establishment of the Jewish state and any compensation or repayment to the victims of the Holocaust. There's none. Israel, this is a kind of watery myth that persists, that somehow Israel was intended or ended up being, whether it was intended or not, as a gift to the Jews for how they suffered under the Nazis. But that's not a part of it. There's no such connection. Yet, the typical American mind, as well as the mindset of the American Congress, their mindset and their pocketbooks, pack pocketbooks, favors the Israelis to the point of bending to Israel's will when it comes to this more than $3 billion per year military foreign aid, U.S. foreign aid, all in the form of military assistance to Israel. Not counting Afghanistan and Iraq, Israel receives more foreign aid than any other country on earth. The tiny country of Israel receives more military aid, more U.S. foreign aid than the entire continent of Africa. And as for Afghanistan and Iraq, those are budgetary differences. They do not fall under the Washington's administrative category of military aid. This is a special case. It really has everything to do with the U.S. covering our asses, the government covering its ass, regarding how we mess things up. Killing close to 1 million Iraqis, and who knows how many Afghanistanis we killed in the wake of the 9/11 attacks in New York City and Washington. Don't forget Shanksville County, Pennsylvania. We had to go in and get the push the Taliban aside to get to Al-Qaeda. We keep hearing that Al-Qaeda has been reversed to almost nothingness in its numbers and its influence. But they're not completely erased. And we've only served to, if anything, increase the ranks of the Taliban and the appeal of the Taliban to many Muslims. That's what I appreciate in this Sentinel article, Kerry Pushes Ambitious Mideast Peace Plan. Always ambitious, and every time a dismal failure in the end. What I like in this article is, I'll read you this quotation again for the third time. Kerry says, it is reported in the article, "I am intensely focused on this issue and the region because it is vital, really, to American interests and regional interests to try to advance the peace process." Well, nothing new there. But then he says, "And because this festering absence of peace is used by groups everywhere to recruit and encourage extremists." This festering absence of peace is used by groups everywhere to recruit and encourage extremists, end quote, Kerry told reporters. Well, I'm not blaming us, the Christians, the Jews, the non-Muslims, for encouraging extremism. But by our tacit approval and our active approval, we are encouraging this backlash from a part of the world that has been so long separated, usually from the Christian world, when, if anything, we should be building bridges and connecting to them. It is 1600 hours Pacific Daylight Time. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial, streaming live in the World Wide Web. Just go to www.freakradio, that's F-R-E-A-K radio.org. Scroll down the main page, Just a little bit. You'll see a cartoon picture of a radio tower. Hint, hint. We need a new one. We need land for relocation of our current one, actually. Any ideas? Connect with someone there at the website or call me here in the studio. I'll give the numbers in a second. So you scroll down that front page. Look at the tower. Look at the top of the tower. There is a pretty reddish, orangish, pinkish oval atop the tower. Click on that oval with your left mouse button. And that should direct you to the site. Of course, you need to have your speakers on. Hopefully, you already have your computer set up with a receptive program such as Real Player, Windows Media, or iTunes, or one of those, so you can bring in the signal. So when you're not within the bounds of the city of Santa Cruz, you can listen to us anywhere in the world with access to the World Wide Web at freakradio.org. Scroll down the front page, click on the red oval. Also, if you want to personally leave me your suggestions or ideas for a new piece of real estate to plant our signal tower on, or for you real estate files who may have information on a potential new studio for $300 or less a month, which is realistically what we can afford to be financially stable here. If you have those suggestions or can help us with that or have any other messages for me, you can direct them to MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's the email address for this show, for this one show, Mideast Madness. Mideast Madness. I may have also said Military Madness. I don't know why I keep wanting to do that. It's Mideast Madness, all small case letters all run together, at gmx.com. And I'll get your message that way about anything. And, of course, those phone numbers are 427-3772, area code 831, 427-3772. We have some 52 minutes left of programming. That's line one. Line two, if the first one is busy or you have some prejudice against the number one, area code 831-469-3119. 469-3119. The lines are open. The Gentner buttons are properly set. I just don't see no lights flashing. Hey, folks, how about a musical break? We're going to hear from who else? Yes, Stuart Davis. My bud from Minnesota. I was reading a review of one of his compact discs yesterday, and the individual really lauded the guy and referred to him as Minnesota's strangest son. No question about that. And let's raise some hackles here. Let's click it on over to number 11.
With my wallet fat, I ordained myself a diplomat. I bought a plane in some aerosol, spread my name on China's wall.
stock in Korea, tainted food shelves in Tanzania, tart Saigon like a police fire alarm, slash tires in the streets of Cairo, architect Castro's doorway, I whipped on the king of Norway, 18 days of Rome, Japan, choking little kids with my bare hands.
Oh, how I do wish I can continue and play the whole album. I never get tired of that guy. Stuart Davis. Born in Minnesota, conceived in Iowa. It's not like I was there, but I mean, I am older than him, but anyway. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. Available to you on the FM radio dial at 101.3, streaming live at freeradio.org. Send your messages and concerns and queries to Mideast Madness's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's G as in Gory, M as in Muslim, X as in xylophone.com. I mean, I'm not a Muslim. It's just in reference to first thing that came to my mind when I wanted an example for the letter M. Okay. Speaking of Theodore Herzl, came across this today, just today. Somebody sent me a YouTube video of Israelis singing in Hebrew, a song of protest in solidarity with the Palestinians. I'll just play it for you. It's in Hebrew. It says, "We went on Israeli Independence Day, Rabin Square, Tel Aviv, to celebrate the ethnic cleansing along with the people of Israel." Ethnic cleansing referring to, of course, to the ethnic cleansing of Palestinian Arabs. "We distributed maps prepared by Zokrot, documenting," I can't remember what Zokrot is, and I don't have the rest of the descriptive quote, but let me see. Let's push this sucker up here and I'll play the song for you. Maybe you can translate for us. Assuming it begins. It does have subtitles, so actually I'll go ahead and translate it for you. Unfortunately, the YouTube doesn't seem to be wanting to come on. That's a shame. Let me try this. I'll refresh this page. If that doesn't take half of forever. You know, historically, May 15th is Israeli Independence Day, although the question persists, independence from whom? Great Britain was the colonial European power in charge, but they had announced 6 months prior to Independence Day that they were pulling out, that they were in the process of pulling out. So Israel's, or the Jewish state areas, as the UN defined it initially, was due for independence anyway. So was the Arab state area before the horror of the Zionist ethnic cleansing began and closing in on the Arab state area and reduced its size. I'll try this link here. Still nothing. Okay, I don't want to waste your time anymore. I'm sorry, YouTube's not cooperating with us. But Mazim Kumsie and his author of his human rights newsletter / blog made the following comments today, April 22nd. "We went on Israeli Independence Day in Rabin Square, Tel Aviv, to celebrate the, quote, ethnic cleansing along with the people of Israel. We distributed maps prepared by Zokrot." I forget exactly who or what Zokrot is. But the maps were documenting the names of all, with a map of Palestine and Israel, the names of every last little and not so small Arab village that was erased from the earth following the flight of Palestinian refugees, the flight in terror from murdering Zionists who committed dozens and dozens of massacres in the process of establishing and securing their long self-promised land of Israel. And I have a wide range of estimations that have been made from roughly 400 to over 900 villages and communities were destroyed after they were vacated by the fleeing refugees, those who would become refugees in Palestine. And the newly formed Israelis bulldozed and tore apart these villages and their mosques, in most cases, empty villages, really, so the Palestinians would have nothing to come back to, even if, by some miracle, the refugees managed to make it back to their general region. They distributed the maps by Zohrat, listing the names of all these villages, hundreds of them, hundreds, and pinpointing them on the map. Here's a quotation from Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern-day political Zionism. Quote, "For Europe, we would constitute over there, in Palestine, part of a bulwark against Asia as well as the advanced post of civilization against barbarism." End quote. This was written in Judenstadt, German for the Jewish state, 1896, Theodor Herzl. "For Europe, we would constitute in Palestine part of a bulwark against Asia, as well as the advanced post of civilization against barbarism." Here's another quote. "Within a few years, the wars of consolidation and expansion began. Ironically enough, the horrors of the Holocaust became the rationalization for the preparation by Zionists of acts of genocide against the indigenous people of Palestine. Those of us who, in the years that were to follow, raised our voices publicly against the violent apartheid of the Israeli state were vilified by the Zionist press." End quote. That from Joe Slovo, S-L-O-V-O, ANC leader, that would be the African National Congress leader, a leader in the ANC who happened to be Jewish. I'll read it again. Joe Slovo of the ANC, once upon a time, who was Jewish, said, and I quote, "Within a few years, the wars of consolidation and expansion began. Ironically enough, the horrors of the Holocaust became the rationalization for the preparation by Zionists of acts of genocide against the indigenous people of Palestine. Those of us who, in the years that were to follow, raised our voices publicly against the violent apartheid of the Israeli state were vilified by the Zionist press." End quote. Vilified, of course, as in villain. To be vilified by someone means to be bad-mouthed by them, to have your words and your very existence even condemned. Mazin Kumsiye, in his Human Rights Newsletter, ends with this paragraph. "Action. The Palestinian people inside historic Palestine and in exile, call for a global mobilization on the Nakba Day, 15 May 2013. Nakba, of course, being the Arabic word for catastrophe. Against apartheid and colonization, and for the rights of the Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and lands. We urge you to organize events in your cities or to join existing ones. We also urge you to engage in all forms of popular resistance, including the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS, civil disobedience, demonstrations, and media work, etc. Justice is the only route to peace. End of dispatch. I always find myself worrying whenever I hear the goal or read about the goal of Palestinians returning to their homes and lands. I automatically, inherently, flinch a little bit because I don't want to see the same kind of ethnic cleansing, even in reverse, or reverse, if that is indeed the case, happening, where the Jews are either pushed into the sea or just pushed out of the way. So the, by this time, ancient homes of many of the, most of the Palestinian refugees are reoccupied by their original residents. I see an impending hypocrisy there. But then again, let's get real, folks. Is that ever going to happen? I mean, what's the, what is the nearest likelihood that Arab refugees are going to be given half a chance at returning to their communities or the rough location of their original communities? And if their home is still standing, to be sure, occupied either by most likely an Israeli Jewish family or turned into an office space or school or mental hospital or whatever, if not knocked down and replaced by a modern construction. I don't see it happening anytime soon. So why should I flinch when I read about those, that terrible threat of Palestinians wanting to throw Israelis into the sea? Yeah, like the refugees are gonna be coming over the hills with pitchforks and stones, like the barbarians, back into the Jewish homeland. That was a really short piece. I spent an awful long time on it. And speaking of the Palestinian Nakba catastrophe, let's, where is it? I think last week I did say something about Deir Yassin. Deir Yassin is the most infamous massacre perpetrated on mostly unarmed citizens, including men, women, and children, 62 years ago in the campaign for a new Israel. But I'm pretty sure I did not read this particular one. Again, I believe it was, April 9, 1948, over about 5 weeks before the declaration of the State of Israel and the attempt of neighboring Arab countries to restore order when they sent their Arabs, their armies in. My friends Daryl and Sue, on the 9th of April 2013, write, "Dear friends, I thought you might find this of interest. Our Holy Land tour in December to January will visit both Deir Yassin and Deir Yassin and Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem. This account was written by a Palestinian survivor of the Deir Yassin massacre. There are many factual accounts of this human tragedy, though not many are known in the U.S. It helps us to understand why there is so much resistance among Palestinians to the ongoing occupation and confiscation of Palestinian land by Israeli Jewish settlers, and their insistence on, quote, the right of return, end quote. as well as the determination of many in Israel to whitewash this history and shift attention to Israel's security concerns with Iran while continuing to quietly expropriate more and more Palestinian West Bank territory. Daryl and Sue continue here. For a more definitive and detailed study of the Deir Yassin story, see the series of essays in Remembering Deir Yassin, The Future of Israel and Palestine, edited by Daniel McGowan and Dr. Mark Ellis, 1998, Olive Branch Press, page 150. I heard Mr. Ellis speak sometime last year. He is Jewish himself and has endeavored to bring attention of all Americans, including his fellow Jews, to the hypocrisy of Zionism and how Zionism is not equivocal to Judaism. He has suffered for his message. He was fired from a Mr. Kenneth Starr, yes, that Kenneth Starr, from his post at a college in Waco, Texas, and I believe he is now located in Southern California. I don't know if he was fired outright, but they gave him a real hard time for even coming from that position. Okay, thanks, Daryl and Sue. Someone named Hassan writes this preface. Today, please remember Deir Yassin. This massacre took place 62 years ago on April 9, 1948. The date and location are significant. It took place 36 days before the May 14 Israel's Declaration of Independence and the subsequent war. This date exposes the Zionist lie that the refugee fled because of the war. The location in West Jerusalem exposes another lie that the Zionists accepted the UN partition plan. Please look at the map of the UN partition plan. And obviously not being able to do that over the radio, I will point out to you that the UN's parameters between the suggested or the imposed Jewish state area and those of the Arab state area were quite different by the beginning of 1949 when the armistices were finally signed in that struggle. The original Jewish state area was some 56% of historic Palestine, British Mandate Palestine, 56%, and they ended up with 78%. Now, with all the Arab nations invading and surrounding and trying to toss the Jews into the sea, quote-unquote, supposedly, how did that happen? Somebody call me and tell me. There's still plenty of time to call here. Call live to the studio at 831-427-3772 or 469-3119. And this Hassan here, Mr. Hassan, ends his paragraph with the quote, "Justice delayed is justice denied." Okay, here we go. Brief history of Deir Yassin before the massacre. For centuries, the village of Deir Yassin, 3 miles west of Jerusalem, was a peaceful place in Palestine. The Arabic word Deir means monastery. In the early 18th century, around 1742, a nomadic Arab Bedouin and his family settled in this village. His name was Al-Sheikh Muhammad Al-Yassin. The village was named after Sheikh Muhammad Al-Yassin and known ever since as Deir Yassin. The massacre at Deir Yassin, April 9, 1948. In 1948, Zionist preparations for the massacre at Deir Yassin had begun. The terrorist Zionist/Jewish Stern Gang put forward a proposal to massacre the residents of the village in order to show the Arabs what happens when the Irgun and Stern gangs unite in their operations. One of the aims of the attack was to, quote, break Arab morale, end quote, and create panic throughout Palestine. Deir Yassin overlooks Jerusalem from its high mountain point. Taking Deir Yassin was militarily strategic to Zionist plans to empty Palestine of its indigenous inhabitants. In the early morning of April 9, 1948, the peaceful village of Deir Yassin was attacked and its inhabitants massacred by the terrorist Zionist Irgun and Stern gangs led by none other than Menachem Begin, future Prime Minister of Israel, and Benzion Cohen, respectively. Begin, leader of the Irgun, and Cohen of the Stern gang. The Irgun and Stern gangs butchered everyone in their way, men, women, and some were pregnant, and children, to empty the entire village. The massacre was designed to terrify Arabs beyond the village of Deir Yassin, so that they would run away and thus be driven out of their homes. This explains why the Zionist/Jewish death squads did not bury the men, women, and children they killed. They left the dead bodies to be seen and frighten other Palestinian Arabs. Those who were still alive were taken by the Zionist terrorist gangs and loaded into trucks with their hands tied and eyes blindfolded. They were paraded through the streets of Jerusalem while the Palestinian Zionist/Jews applauded and celebrated the dehumanization of Palestinian Arabs. Call me if you want to talk about this now. I am reading from a brief history of Deir Yassin before the massacre, which is written by Abbas Hamideh, survivor of the massacre and now an American citizen. I shall continue. And celebrated the dehumanization of Palestinian Arabs. After the humiliation through the streets of Jerusalem, the survivors were taken back to Deir Yassin and lined up against a wall and systematically sprayed with gunfire and killed. 53 orphan children were literally dumped along the walls of the old city of Jerusalem, where they were found by Hind Husseini. She took them to her home, which is located behind the current American Colony Hotel. Interesting name, American Colony Hotel. How descriptive, eh? And they became the first class of Dar al-Tifl al-Arabi orphanage. A few weeks later, Israel, and the man writes the word Israel in quotation marks, declared itself a state and was recognized almost immediately as such by American President Harry Truman. With the exception of a few, the graves of the martyrs of Deir Yassin will not be known because they were bulldozed by the, quote, State of Israel, end quote, apparently to make way for new Jewish settlers. The terrorist criminals who perpetrated the Deir Yassin massacre were never punished or brought to justice. Instead, they were rewarded, and one former leader of the Irgun gang, Menachem Begin, became prime minister soon after. Well, 25, 30 years after, maybe. Some 20 years. Yeah, that's fairly soon. Later, the renowned war criminal Ariel Sharon continued to carry out the slow genocide set in motion by the European/U.S. Zionist project against Arab countries that continues until this day. Morton A. Klein of the Zionist Organization of America published a report entitled Deir Yassin, History of a Lie, that claims that there was no massacre at Deir Yassin. To deny Deir Yassin is like denying the Nazi Judeocide in Europe during World War II. The massacre at Yer Yassin is as true as the Nazi Holocaust in Europe. The village of Yer Yassin was only one of many massacres perpetrated by the Zionist Israelis. Again, Israelis in quotes, quotation marks, to terrorize the indigenous people. Other Palestinian towns and villages where massacres occurred include Ein Karim, Kakun, Tantura, Yaffa, which is current-day Tel Aviv, a small city within itself, Safad, Sufsaf, with 115 people massacred at the wall of Sufsaf Mosque, Haifa, another small city, Tiret Haifa, Jibsu, and many more. The Safsuf residents witnessed their second massacre in Shatila refugee camp in Lebanon 34 years later in 1982. The war criminal Ariel Sharon was directly responsible for that massacre. And that is not just according to world opinion, folks. Sharon's own Israeli government, and sitting at the time, found him guilty. They might not have called it a massacre, but they did indeed found him culpable and responsible. And at the time, that sitting Israeli regime forbade Ariel Sharon from ever again holding high office. And wouldn't you know it, only a few years later, Mr. Sharon ended up as leader of that country, the prime minister. Wonderful, democratic, and democratically inspired political process in old Jerusalem, in the Knesset. I shall continue with this history of the massacre at Yer Yassin. Contrary to the Zionist belief that, quote, the old will die and the young will forget, end quote, 60 years later, some of our elders may have died, but the young still remember. Exclamation point. The descendants of Yer Yassin, the Palestinian refugees and people on the ground at home and elsewhere, continue to struggle for the time when we can claim our absolute sacred individual and collective right to return to our original homes and lands. And then, in bold type and underlined in its entirety, is the paragraph. United Nations Resolution 194 affirmed the right of Palestinians to return to their homes and lands. This resolution was further clarified by UN General Assembly Resolution 3236, which reaffirmed in subsection 2, quote, the inalienable right of Palestinians to return to their homes and property from which they have been displaced and uprooted, and calls for their return, end quote. Palestinians' right to return is specifically to their original homes and lands, and not simply what may be designated as a Palestinian state in the future. End of paragraph, bold typed and underlined. The above summary was written by Abbas Hamideh, survivor of the massacre of Yer Yassin and now an American citizen. Abbas is available for interviews today. See also the Wikipedia, and I'll give you the website, http://en.wikipedia.org/wiki/Yer Yassin, and that's spelled D-E-I-R under dash for the proper site. Yassin, Y-A-S-S-I-N. And this information was also brought to us by the NorCal Sabil Group. NorCal Sabil Group, which I believe is headquartered in the San Francisco Bay Area somewhere, possibly San Jose. Let me talk a little bit about this notion that Thierry Yassin is a lie and never really happened, or at least it wasn't a massacre. Folks, I do appreciate your listenership to this radio program, which I hope you supplement with some regularity with something in writing, newspapers, something you researched at the library, reliable textbooks, which hopefully you can rely upon. Even stuff which may be nastily referred to as revisionist by those who don't want to upset the cart of Israel being in power and receiving all the money help that it wants from the U.S. taxpayer. Supplement this show with some proper study. And by all means, don't rely on YouTube. I mean, there's really good stuff on YouTube, and then there's, you know, so-so stuff. And a lot of lies, just like TV, folks. A lot of lies on television, right? A lot of lies on radio. Ultimately, it's for you to decide who is right. YouTube is just another form of TV, a distraction, a diversion, often from reality altogether. There is this, in my opinion, really awful YouTube entitled The Myth of Thierry Yassin. And somehow they lined up people, apparently Arabs, dressed in Arab garb anyway, who speak in Arabic, or those speaking in Hebrew, and the translation given on the screen translate these individuals as saying, no, that it didn't really happen. We just made it sound as bad as we could for the newspaper reporters. And this particular offensive to me and to the truth, YouTube video talks about the military necessity, which we read about in part just now in the piece I read to you, of capturing Thierry Yassin was necessary for strategic purposes, as it was on the hilltop overlooking Jerusalem, and there were Jews in the old city down there who were being denied supply by the Arab Legion, who was fighting a war for their independence, as it turns out. And the YouTube video continued. It said outrageous things like, the poorly armed Zionist partisans. That is bull. They had the best armaments, both as individual soldiers and collectively. They had artillery, some limited artillery. I don't know if they had tanks, but they did have motorized mobility, at least for moving troops. They had high-class, recently manufactured and illegally smuggled into Palestine submachine guns, as they were called back in those days, submachine guns on slings that they wore and used. They even had a small air force. They even had some airplanes that they used for bombing and strafing, or for one of those two. And again, the YouTube essentially calls the Arabs all liars, who were trying to make the flight of 750,000 Arabs a joke or a lie or something not for people not to pay serious attention to. And what I just read you, he makes mention, Mr. Abbas Hamideh, the survivor of the massacre, points out how, yeah, Morton A. Klein of the Zionist Organization of America published a report entitled Thierry Yassin, quote, History of a Lie, that claims there was no massacre at Thierry Yassin. It really hits it on the head how he says the massacre at Thierry Yassin is as true as the Nazi Holocaust in Europe. And to deny Thierry Yassin is like denying the Nazi Judea site in Europe during World War II. I really appreciate his pointing that out. In more ways than one, what the Zionist militants have done is categorically Nazi-like in nature. I guess when terrible wrongs are perpetrated on one people, there is this awful human nature tendency to take it out on someone else, even when they have convinced themselves that this is for their ultimate good. All right. It's 4:48. Show ends in 7 minutes. Please do consider sending your donations to Free Radio Santa Cruz. We depend on the little person in addition to its programmers. I know the economy is far from being out of a hole yet that the Republicans created 5 years ago, but you know, do what you can. Please send something to perpetuate this radio service and Mideast Madness every Monday at 3 p.m. Send your donations to Post Office Box 7811. That's P.O. Box 7811. Santa Cruz, California, 95061. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. Still time to call the area code 831-427-3772, 469-3119. Most of my shows, most of Mideast Madness is archived at the website radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, the character 4, all, A-L-L dot N-E-T, radioforall.net. Just look for Military Madness and click on a podcast. Warning, the last time I tried to pick up a podcast on my home computer from Radio For All, it took almost an hour for the thing to download. That might have been a localized problem. But you know how unreliable these things are when it comes to the internet. And, of course, if you are listening to an archive show, either from Radio For All or from Santa Cruz Indie Bay, or if you're hearing a show which is rebroadcast in the course of the week, certainly this evening more than once, remember, it is indeed a rerun. You won't be able to call in unless you make it a point to tune in next week at the appointed time of 3 o'clock p.m. My name is Ren Tawil. This is the Mideast Madness Show. If I sound like I'm just blithering on here, it's most likely because I'm waiting for the pewter here to finish doing its thing and show me what I need to show you. One more item. I've got about 5 minutes left, but I want to at least start this. If I always think I know where these... Oh, here it is. Here. From the Anti-Discrimination Committee. This is the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, not to be confused with the Jewish ADL, or Anti-Defamation League. These are the good guys. Snicker, snicker. Should we legalize Israel's discrimination against Arab Americans? AIPAC, that's the American-Israel Political Affairs Committee, is pushing for a provision in the U.S.-Israel Strategic Partnership Act of 2013, quote-unquote, which would allow Israeli citizens to enter the United States without a visa, but, believe it or not, would allow Israel to continue its discrimination against U.S. citizens of Arab descent. The State Department notes in its official travel advisory, quote, U.S. citizens of Arab or Muslim origin have experienced significant difficulties in entering or exiting Israel or the West Bank, end quote. That's the State Department talking, folks. There are 37 countries who participate in the visa waiver program, a program that allows citizens of those countries to enter the U.S. without a visa. In return, U.S. citizens can enter those countries without visas. These 37 countries are expected to grant all United States citizens, without exceptions, the right to enter their territories without a visa. In other words, my friends, AIPAC is pushing for a loophole, a provision in the, quote, U.S.-Israel Strategic Partnership Act of 2013. And inclusion of the current year is indicative to me of just another way of solidifying not only the cultural and monetary links between the two countries, but the emotional strangulation that Zionism has on the United States. Provision in the U.S.-Israel Strategic Partnership Act of 2013, which would allow Israeli citizens to enter the U.S. without visa, but would allow Israel to continue its discrimination against U.S. citizens of Arab descent when they try to enter or perhaps even leave the United States. And there are instances I've read about where Americans of Arab descent or Muslims going to the United States or wherever else have had difficulty even leaving the country, particularly in the airport, where they can be retained for a couple of hours. It's so bad that it is said LAX, Los Angeles International Airport, is a division of the State of Israel because they Israelis or Israeli sympathetic security people at the airport do essentially the same thing in regards to flights from L.A. to Israel, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, or wherever, Ben Gurion Airport. They want an exception so they don't have to live up to the letter and the spirit of the same visa waiver program that 37 countries participate in. Once again, Israel wants special treatment. After all, as they love to say, Israel has a special relationship with the U.S. and vice versa. Take action. Contact your senators now. Ask them to drop the provision that would legalize Israel's discrimination against Arab Americans. Israel's ethnic and religious profiling of U.S. citizens should not be accommodated by our laws. Let me just close with this last short paragraph of the dispatch. In the last few years, ADC has received hundreds of complaints from Arab American citizens who have been denied entry through Israeli borders. If you or someone you know were denied entry, contact our legal department. That's the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee's legal department. They're on the web at ADC.com, ADC at ADC.org. Thanks, folks. It's time for me to leave. Actually, I have to sit around for an hour or so I can do the closing procedures. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. Join me next week at 3 o'clock for Mideast Madness. Drop a line to me at MideastMadness@gmx.com. Thank you, and the what you call
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, April 22nd, 2013. Hunger-striking political detainee Samer al-Isawi announces that he will stop his hunger strike and settlers attack his family. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian Minister of Detainees Isa Karakeh reported that hunger-striking Palestinian detainee Samer al-Isawi, who's been refusing food since more than 250 days, expressed a conditional acceptance of an Israeli offer to end his strike in exchange of his release on October 10th this year, adding that no official agreement has been reached on the issue yet. Karakeh said that Israeli security officers offered to release Isawi